Alec, you took part in an astonishing 10 and a half convoys.
I
was involved in the D-Day invasion in France on the 6th of June, 1944. Can you tell us a little bit about D-Day?
D-Day?
Yeah.
Well, not a lot, because I was two decks down below, and all I had was a telephone, but we weren't even told where we were. What happened? We left Taylor the Bank in Glasgow early hours of the morning. I was on middle watch, and when we came up, I looked out of the embarkation space, because we wasn't allowed on the flight deck because of our hearing, and I could see on one side of me a massive shipping as far as the eye could see, right over to the horizon, every type of shipping, and the waves were quite heavy and strong. And on the other side, I could see houses and trees and everything else, and inquire where we were. Nobody knew. It wasn't until one of the Bunting Toffers come down from the bridge and said, "I know where we are. We're off the Isle of Wight." He said, "I've just seen the Needles." So that's the only time we knew where we were. And we never, ever thought that the invasion was going to be done this way, because on all our trips up to Mermansk, there was so much activity going off in the Scottish Islands with camouflage nets and tanks and God knows what else, and a whole lot of air traffic going on, that we really thought the invasion was going to be through Norway. And we were convinced of it. And it was only when we got a swing around the anchor in Sandown Bay that I realised that we were going across on a short trip like that. And that was it.
Right. What ship were you serving on at that point?
On Campania.
Oh, you saw it. Okay. Right.
I was cap on her. Yeah. We were cover force. We weren't part of the invasion. We were just cover force. My job was to stop any U-boats coming out of Brest, which was the U-boat pens, and to stop them coming up and hitching the fleet going across. I mean, I never saw anything of the landings going on. Could hear what was going on, especially when their big guns opened up to start bombarding the coast. Like, you know, when our planes went up there, they're all painted with the white stripes overnight, and to signify they were British planes. Everything had to come from second hand, from one of our mates on the bridge who left the telephone open, and we could hear the noise going on up there, like 27 feet beneath the waterline on there.
So, Alec, I need to ask. I have it from a very reliable source, James being sat with you, that you had a run in with the KGB.
They had bombing range every half hour. So we used to get a load of air raids all the time. And any medical supplies that we could spare would go around. And because I was a spare hand, I was coxswain of a 60-foot motorboat, which wasn't used up in the Arctic waters except once. And I was always fished out. And a KGB man would also escort the most senior officer on board, which sometimes was a midshipman with the captain's coat on, like in his cap, to go to the hospital. If we showed the bag to the guard, and he would look through it and just make sure there was no contraband in it, cigarettes or anything like that, and then hand it back. And then the next thing, the KGB man would then open the bag and have a look in. And we saw him look at different packets and put them in his pocket. When I went to speak to the officer, one look told me not to say a word. Be quiet, don't say nothing. What was he taking? All the May and Baker, the penicillin ones on there. Right. He's putting them in his pocket. And anyway, when we left there on that trip, I went round again to the various ships collecting what medical supplies they could afford for the way home. And I saw one of the sick berth attendant on board my ship and explained to him I wanted to empty all the May and Baker tablets out and fill them up with number nines, which are the constipation pills. And sure enough, he died down there, picked them up. I never saw him next time.
Never saw surprised. Him
One way I get my own back.
So, Alec, in September 1945, the Second World War ended. So, How did you feel at the end of the war, and what was kind of next in store for you?
Well, 1945, well, when the war finished over here, as I say, well, I was kept looking for three U-boats that hadn't surrendered. And we finally found they'd scuttled their boats in a remote Norwegian port and made their way back, if they ever did get back, through Norway, back to Germany. And so consequently, by the time I got back to England, V-Day was all over. All the bunting was down and everything else, you see. And I was given 16 days leave, 14 days leave and 2 days VE leave. And I went back to my barracks in Scotland, and there was a notice up there, wanted for early release, anyone with knowledge of the building trade to help rebuild our towns and cities, bricklayers, woodworkers, electricians. As I was a qualified electrician, I thought, this is lovely. So I put my name down, came back to London, and I'd already got engaged to my lovely girlfriend just after D-Day. And I told her what had a company gave her, the 2 weeks' notice, a leave of absence to spend with me. And sure enough, at the end of that time, I thought, right, this is great. I'm going back there. I've got to be put somewhere in London. When I got back into my barracks, I was sent for. They said, have we got a draft for you, son?
Where is it?
HMS Golden Hind. Golden Hind? Where's that? Well, you're going on HMS Amethyst, really, but you go to Golden Hind first at the transit camp. But where's the Amethyst? Oh, out the Yangtze. I said, no, I put my name down to rebuild London. Too late, son. You're wanted out of the Far East. So I said, well, I want embarkation leave. When you're talking about it, I said 16 days leave. I said, I'm a disembarkation. I want embarkation leave. No, you can't have it. I said, yes, I can. King's Regulations said I can. So anyway, I said, well, the only thing you can do, 7 days leave, which includes 2 days travelling. So I came all the way back from Scotland again, met my young lady outside the factory. And she thought I deserted because I'd only been back 24 hours. What's happened? I've got a draft. So I said, will you marry me? And she said, well, I've got to ask my mum and dad, because I mean, we're both minors that time. So anyway, she said, I'd love to marry you. And I said, well, I'd love to marry you too. So I saw her parents, and my father already died. So my mother thought I was still a good catch anyway, because they agreed there. So we went to see the vicar of our local church, and he said, I'd love to marry you, he said, but unfortunately, I've got 3 weeks to call the bands. I said, well, I've got 3 weeks, I've only got 4 days. Can't do it. He said, but I'll tell you what, he said, I have a civil service, and I'm a blessing. She said, no, I want a church wedding. Oh, okay. So he said, well, the only other thing is, if you go down to Westminster Abbey, ask for audience with the Archbishop of Canterbury, tell him your story, and he may be able to help you. So next day, which was just 3 days before I was due to come back, we got trained down. I said, well, he's at Fulham Palace, get him over here. He came over, and the first thing we had to do was swear on the Bible that we hadn't touched each other. We were absolutely pure. There was no question at all about that. And he said, well, now, he said, I'll tell you what, I will marry you now in one of the chapels of the Abbey with two of the Abbey men as your witnesses. I said, will you? Yeah. I said, oh, thank you very much. My fiancé said, oh, no, I want my mum and dad to organise that for you. He said, but what I can do is to give you a special licence which tells any Church of England vicar has got to marry you with 3 hours' notice on there. I've got a beautiful parchment, big red seal on it. Oh, that is right. It's signed by him. I've still got it on the wall. So I went back and saw our vicar at the local church. And he said, well, I can't do it tomorrow because I've got two baptisms on. I can do it on Saturday. I said, no, I can't be back on Saturday. And I said, well, the only thing, I'll send a telegram to my skipper. And he must have had a sympathetic ear because he gave me an extra 48 hours. So I got married at 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. And at 7 o'clock on the Monday morning, I said, oh, goodbye to my lovely new wife. And I went off to Liverpool to come out to the Far East. And
most importantly, though, Alec, were her parents there? Were the parents there?
Oh yes. There's a big family photo, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Beautiful wedding. Yeah. And I still slept on the floor that night. She slept in the bed. That was her idea.
Was that a sign of things to come?
I knew two police that had married her on there. Come on the Monday when I left, I picked up the Manxman at Liverpool, and we went out through the Panama Canal.
Alec, you've lived a remarkable life and remained like extremely busy throughout, and almost, you probably could argue, a bit of an unstoppable force, really. I'm told that you're the nation's oldest poppy seller. Next year, we've got the 80th anniversary of the D-Day celebrations. Alec, just what does Remembrance Day really mean to you?
My father, when he was severely wounded in the Second Battle of the Somme, he was left for dead. And it means to me so very, very much, not only of my father, but of all the other. When you've been to France, you've seen them.
I'm actually intending to go next year.
Yeah. And to me, it means so much that people were so willing to give up for our country and to fight for what they believed to be their way of wanted of life, they would give up their life for it. And it meant so much, really, and still does. I'm just so lucky to be alive at this time. I don't know why. They say the devil looks after his own, but there you go. But I don't know why that I'm still spared to meet people like you, like these lovely people that are looking after me, especially to George and Tanya on here, wonderful friends and relations, and to think that they have given up their time, efforts and everything else just to look after me. And it was this year, it's going to be something special, because George and I, as you know, were over in Normandy this year, and I managed to find my cousin's grave. He was one of the Red Devils that dropped in just before D-Day.
Oh, that's incredible. That's incredible. Look, so obviously you've co-authored a book called My 10 and a Half, How It Conveys the Rest of My Life.
Yes.
James, could you expand on it a little bit and just maybe tell how people listening could actually get a copy?
Yes, certainly. It's a paperback. We sell it for £16 plus postage. We've also done a DVD. The book is of Alec's whole life, from a little child up until recently. The DVD is just Alec talking about his Second World War experience. That's 2 hours, 20 minutes long, and that's £12 plus postage. Now, anybody who's interested only needs to send me an email. My email address is James King, all lowercase, jamesking21@sky.com. And if they do, and I've got their email address, I can send them back more details. The book is, I mean, you've heard some of what Alec's been talking about this afternoon. It's full of amazing stories, a lot of which he hasn't had time to tell you. And the museums are showing great interest in the DVD, but which we can also deliver that as a memory stick if people prefer it.
Alec, James, Tanya and George, thanks very much for your time today. On behalf of Flying Veterans UK, thanks for sharing your stories with us. I'm sure this will be enjoyed by many people, both young and old. It's been a real honour to listen and explore parts of your incredible life, Alec.
I didn't think it was incredible. It's just these people did.
don't say that. Nobody's going to buy your book.
Thank you so much. You are more than welcome on my humble abode. You've got my telephone number. Please don't hesitate. I've got books and photos and God knows what else. I don't know what's going to happen to when I go, but I'll probably finish up in a skip.